Hello and welcome to the podcast of the Lotus Eaters for the 1st of May 2024. And I'm very pleased to have a guest here today, and that is Aidan Paladin.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
Thank you very much for coming. And of course, we have Harry.
Hello, it's been a while. I've brought my own guest with me, my Manky mug.
Yeah,
so that's making its a long overdue reappearance on the podcast.
By the way, I offered to buy Harry a new mug because I object to how disgusting it is. And he actually refused. I offered him charity.
It's becoming kindness. A running thing. And also, once again, somebody did say that they had sent me an HP Lovecraft mug from America, which has still not arrived. Mm-hmm. So if you sent that and you're watching it right now, it's just not arrived yet. Either you didn't send it and you lied to me, in which case you've completely breached my trust, or it's been picked up by customs because you wrote Lovecraft's cat's name on it.
Mm. Nice reference there.
Mm, so
I think you're just doing your bit to help, you know, the immune system of society here by having all of the germs located in your mug.
It's like the episode of The Simpsons with Mr. Burns. You know, I'm so diseased at this point. If I stop drinking from this and cure one of them, I will die.
Mm.
Anyway, we actually do have a podcast to record today.
Podcast.
What?
This is what. This is all people want.
This isn't
what
real.
People tune in for.
No. So we're going to be discussing what is wrong with the left and also the next evolution of white flight.
Are we sure we'll have time for my segment? Because, good God, what's wrong with the left?
Well,
I know, yeah.
Yeah, where do you start?
We're going to make this about 5 hours long. No, it's going to be a double segment. Episode. So I suppose I may as well explain why we're going to be talking about it. So obviously we talk about the left on this podcast quite a lot and what they're up to and what their purported aims are and things like that.
How ugly they are.
That's true. I mean, undeniable. Mm. We don't need to really point that one out. It's just obvious. But
just mean.
Mm-hmm. that too. However, I thought as we've got two psychologists in the room, it'd be good to sort of have a deeper look at their actual motivations. Because, of course, understanding their purported reasons for doing what they're doing, that's very, very different to why they actually might be doing it. You know, people aren't always honest. I don't think I need to tell that to people.
Souls say rhetoric versus reality.
Mm-hmm. And I actually think that there are lots of profound insights you can get from there, mm-hmm. You know, from the studies looking at why they behave as they do, rather than, you know, trying to understand the minds of people that quite often are not the sanest, let's be honest. So before I actually get into that, though, it is worth mentioning we are looking for,
Aidan Paladin. We found her.
There she is.
Oh, my God.
No, we are looking.
Search over it.
Looking for a production manager, and I have been given a sentence to read. We are looking for people with skills in videography, audio, and editing available to work in the London or Swindon area. If you are interested in the full job spec, it is available at lotuseaters.com/careers or lotuseaters.com/career-production-manager with hyphens between career production and manager, which is, you know, you can see it on screen. You can read, can't you? If you can read, look at this.
Smooth. Despite looking like a used car salesman, the skills aren't quite up to snuff.
Well, I sell new cars these days.
Oh, all right.
Anyway, on to some of the studies. So this was recently picked up a couple of days ago. This is a study that I think came out of a Mormon university in Utah.
BYU.
BYU, that's the one. Mm-hmm. I can never remember all the acronyms and things like that. But apparently, liberals are three times more biased than conservatives when evaluating ideologically opposite individuals. And this is obviously something that I think lots of people have identified without research. But the research is interesting because, of course, being able to quantify it and understand the scale of the problem is very important. Because quite often I see people saying, well, why do I need a study to vindicate what I already know? Well, actually, scaling is very important in understanding the nature of the issue. You know, it could be 10 times, it could be 2 times. It makes a big difference.
Sure, and it helps to just have any evidence for it in general. Because mm-hmm. otherwise, I mean, sure, some things are known just because you can observe them, but you need to be able to quantify them so that you can show other people, and particularly when the party of science, the left, says that they want evidence for everything. That's the case until they don't like the actual evidence. It seems, or at least that's been my experience, as they seem to be a little bit upset about this first one.
Yes, and we are going to be looking at some of the reactions, which just prove the actual study, which is funny. And they even acknowledge, well, I know it kind of proves what they're saying, but still I'm angry, which is hilarious. So this was actually published in the Journal of Social Psychology, which, despite having some replicability problems is still a relatively prestigious psychological journal. I'm slurring my words. I've not even had a drink today. I'm going to read a little bit from this. And it says, the researchers conducted a study in which they explored how political memes published on social media affect a perceiver's impression of the person who shared them. They also wanted to determine the degree to which the person viewing the memes would indirectly aggress against the person who posted them based on assumptions about the political views of that person. And it says, the conservative and liberal memes and texts were crafted to be as similar as possible, reflecting the opposite political views. For example, I'm just going to say it, I hate Trump, with an angry face emoji, which is not a meme, to be honest. I mean, that's just a statement. I'm just going to say it, I love Trump, with a happy face emoji. This understanding of memes makes me cringe
that a little bit. That feels like such a Facebook boomer meme.
Yeah.
It is. But it also kind of makes it a little bit believable in my mind that it's sort of a little bit out of touch and boomery.
Yeah.
You can kind of believe it.
When it comes to the meme talk, I think it's interesting to point out another aspect of the left-right's meme game, which is one that I've seen pointed out quite often, which is if you ever see a stone toss meme, for instance, oftentimes the people that he is making fun of in the memes are not necessarily the target of the meme. It's the idea that they represent that is the target of the meme. Whereas when you see leftist memes, say, for instance, when Kathy Griffin did that photograph of her holding the severed Trump head, which still gets shared about every so often, it's more about pointing at your ideological opposites and saying, you are evil, you are hideous, you are awful, and you deserve to die.
And I think that this difference exists because the right tends to understand the left better than the left understands the right. Mm. And this is not something that I'm sort of saying baselessly. It seems to be the case that that's backed up in the literature to quite a significant degree, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, lots of people on the right I know of have read lots of leftist literature. The same can't be said on the opposite side.
Oh, and that makes sense then why their memes are this person's evil, they're terrible, because that's all they can come up with are essentially just insults. Because they don't have any, they don't understand what anyone on the right believes, so they don't have anything to make a meme out of.
Mm-hmm. There's another interesting thing there, which is even those on the left that purports to have read right-wing literature often demonstrate in practice that they have a very, very thin and rubbish understanding of it. There was a guy called Matt McManus, who's a professor, who's done a number of debates with the distributist, if you're aware of what that was going on now. This guy professes himself to be an expert on right-wing literature. And then a few weeks ago, he made a post on Twitter that was absolutely absurd for anybody who claims to understand the history of right-wing thought and the development of right-wing ideologies, is that he posted some excerpt from a book and he went, this is completely insane. I can't believe this. I'm only just learning this now. And it was an excerpt from a book showing that explaining that fascism had arisen as a response to communism and that, for instance, Germans in the 1930s saw communists as their greatest enemies, not just Jews. And I thought to myself, what have you missed? You're supposed to be an expert on this stuff. Whether you want to align fascism or National Socialism with the right or left, most on the left to put it on the right, how did you not already know this? You have got such a poor understanding of this if you're only just learning this incredibly basic fact.
I mean, that's a record score for Godwin's law as well, isn't
right,
it?
Right, right.
But no, I very much agree with what you're saying. And so obviously they showed them these memes and then according to the article talking about it, because the paper isn't necessarily publicly available yet, participants read a cover story presenting the study authors as industrial/organizational psychologists developing a machine learning algorithm. So they basically deceived them because they believed that if the participants knew why they were in the experiment, they would change their behavior, which is a very true thing. And one of the main problems with the lab experiments in psychology is that people are aware when they're being observed and they can infer what you're meant to be doing.
Almost, they can almost never guess the cover story, though. Like, because that's very typical to almost always have a cover story. And a lot of times, in order to make sure, you'll actually ask them if they guessed what it was afterwards, so you can use it as a measure to throw out those data if someone does guess what you're actually trying to study.
Funny thing is that a lot of universities recruit psychology students as part of their scheme. And I remember participating in them for credits for my own studies and being able to guess what the study was actually about quite a lot of the time. And it led to a lot of disappointed researchers.
Yeah.
It's basically just a waste of time for everyone at that point. But my gripes about the way university works aside. And so the sort of overall conclusion was that liberals and conservatives tended to evaluate ideologically opposite individuals more negatively, surprise, surprise. However, this bias was 3 times stronger among liberals compared to conservatives. So I think we can all agree that, you know, observation and research seems to match up here quite clearly. But what is to be done about this? And, you know, you could take the annoying sort of centrist trigonometry line of, well, we've got to come together. I reject that entirely and say,
well, we have
to
come together with people who view us as an existential threat and want us dead.
Yeah.
Not sure how.
Yeah, my perspective is that, well, conservatives are tending to be almost too even-handed to these people. That if they're willing to go to great lengths to discriminate against you, well, surely that should get the same in return.
And this was discrimination, is what they were looking at in the study specifically, was would you hire this person for a job? Mm-hmm. Or potentially that's part of it. So yeah, that is active discrimination against someone 3 times stronger for people on the left than it is on the right. And I don't know how you come to the table with someone who would want you to not have a job just because they disagree politically.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's part of the reason that a lot of institutions have shifted leftwards is that they're far more willing to gatekeep them.
Yeah.
And this seems to be the case, right? That leftists are far more likely to push people out of institutions because they are 3 times more likely to discriminate against them. And so, well, what that says to the right is, well, you shouldn't be as tolerant to the left because they're not showing you the same tolerance. And that's how it should work, really. And here's the actual study itself. To meme or not to meme, political social media posts and ideologically motivated aggression in job recommendations. So if you wanted to look at it, you know, straight from the source, there it is. But what I wanted to do, and I'm very sorry for subjecting you all to this, is look at a reaction from a liberal hub that is Reddit. And I try to avoid this sort of thing, particularly the psychology thread, because here someone posted it, and
this header image gets me every time. What do you think the directions were for the photographer for this model? I mean, good God. Sorry, carry on.
I know what you mean. Like, imagine, you know, working for a stock photo company, and this is how you're sort of represented in this article thumbnail. Terrible. Anyway, so the top comment is perfect vindication of this. I mean, I'm not going to trust the Mormons on this. Their entire worldview is skewed. And it
just
says,
right, yeah, over his head.
And then they also said, edit, for those peeing your pants with angry glee, y'all didn't even bother to open the damn journal until I triggered your feelings. Mormons are not grounded in reality, and their scientific article should be taken with a grain of secret gold plates in a hole under a hat that only one person can see. So that is a person absolutely seething. And then the person replying to them there, I just noticed that the study was done at BYU. Now I'm trying to figure out if I'm literally proving their point by being a liberal who is having an instant knee-jerk reaction against my stereotype of Mormon institutions. That person's a sort of evolution in consciousness from that initial poster there. But there are people who... oh, my mouse is not working. Uh-oh. Never mind.
Oh, wait, there you go.
Here we go. Oh.
Slight delay. Oh.
It's not working. Never mind. I can adapt. And there's a comment around here somewhere. Where is it? Basically, someone just saying, yeah, that checks out. Fair enough. I can't find it anymore. There's another person criticizing the methods. They're basically pointing out...
It's funny how they get access to it. Mm-hmm. Unless you have access to the journal right now, which it might be published. I think it has published, but did they pay a lot of money for it? I'm curious. Did they actually read it? Because, of course, that one person is like, oh, you didn't even read it yet. Did you, though? Because, I wouldn't have said that if I had read it.
I think it's easy to see what's going on here, which is I'm in this picture and I don't like it.
Yes.
Yes. And the comment I was trying to find basically said, when the study agrees with what they believe, it's, you know, good methodology. It's all fine. Right. When it disagrees with them, the methodology is bad. And, you know, I've seen studies that agree with me and I've spotted that the methodology is bad.
Yep.
That's part of being a good researcher. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's something you should pride yourself on, not necessarily just being completely partisan. You've got to sort of read between the lines and look for good evidence. So there are also histories of people being biased towards other people as well. Here's a study being talked about at the University of Exeter. who actually recently disciplined someone for saying they didn't agree with veganism in their own room. So a lovely institution. But supposedly, Twitter users 3 times more likely to follow back the accounts of strangers if they share the same political views. Interesting that it's 3 times as well, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
That number just keeps on coming up. So it seems to be a phenomenon. They're also more likely to block others because of politics. Here we have consistently liberal, significantly more likely than, say, mostly conservative or consistently conservative to block people. They're more likely to drop people from being their friend. Look at consistently liberal. That's massive compared to other people. And the reason that, you know, that they're succeeding is because they are gatekeeping to a significant degree. And the right isn't doing this nearly enough. And that's why I think quite often things are going wrong. I don't know whether you guys agree.
I've already done a video speaking about this in the past. The left gatekeeps to the right,
mm-hmm.
and the centre-right gatekeeps to the right as well.
Mm-hmm.
The centre-right often acts as a mechanism by which it is trying to hold the left to its own principles, and then so therefore ends up embodying those principles in a more honest way, because the left are all rhetoric. Mm-hmm. I was discussing this with a friend, Spoon, the other day, and we were discussing this and saying how the two sides often operate opposite to one another in terms of the rhetoric, where the left is all about equal rights and democracy in their rhetoric, where the way they actually operate is incredibly rigidly hierarchical and deferential to power and elitist. The right operates the exact opposite way. Their rhetoric is elitist, it's all about hierarchy, whereas in reality, the principles they try to uphold themselves to are democratic and equal rights based. And so you end up with the right just oftentimes capitulating to the left, at least the center right as it's existed. The William F. Buckley Jr. right, you could say.
Good example, yeah.
And it's more a foundations theory that people who lean to the left only tend to have two values, which is avoiding harm and caring for others, or at least wanting to be seen as if they care for others, which I think we'll talk about later, and a issue with fairness. But again, that's perceived fairness, or perceived justice, not actual justice. Whereas conservatives tend to value all of the morals. So also purity and authority and loyalty. And then liberty only applies to libertarians who are very strong liberty and nothing else in terms of moral values. But yeah, when you only have 2 out of 6 values that you care about, it absolutely shows up like that. Becomes evident that these are the things they care about more than anything being seen as caring about.
Mm-hmm. And this is, of course, having an effect on society, and people are aware of this going on. And it says staunch liberals stand out as only group who feels they can share their political opinions. And that's because they've captured institutions because of this approach to politics.
That's amazing that they can answer in that way and still pretend like they're the ones out of power.
There we go. You can see it a bit better there. So strong conservative, only 23%, disagree that they're being silenced, which is quite a lot compared to the inverse of that, right? But anyway, it's also worth mentioning that they are completely insane. has a doctor or healthcare provider ever told you that you have a mental health condition? Percentage saying yes. And this is an utter condemnation of liberal women right there.
Mm-hmm.
that is leagues above everyone else. I mean, the liberal men are significantly higher as well, but conservative men and women seem to be far more healthy. And I think that the key to this, I don't know.
There's a confound here.
Okay.
The confound is that leftists tend to have and liberals tend to have a more positive sort of perception of mental health. Mm-hmm. So they tend to be more likely to seek out a therapist. So are they really that crazier? I would agree, yes. But there is a confounding variable there, which is that they may be more likely to ask someone to diagnose them with depression or some other mental health condition.
Mm-hmm.
Just a caveat. Yeah.
Given that I would argue that liberals are those who have completely and totally swallowed the propaganda that we've been fed for a long time. Part of that propaganda comes from the therapeutic state. You constantly see therapizing, pathologizing. And one of the ways that people are pathologized is if you behave in a certain way, then you're a fascist. I think these people are absolutely desperate to prove they're not a fascist. And so they will go to these therapists who are constantly being told that you're much better. You'll have a much better life if you go to therapy constantly. Even on YouTube adverts, you get better help is one that I get constantly because you're always being pushed towards it.
I don't necessarily think that fascism's too much to do with it, but I do think that the focus on family and, you know, focusing on your profession, the sort of more traditional lifestyle of the conservative tends to lead to a lifestyle which seems more in keeping with human psychology, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm.
I also think there is the dysgenic element, which is that these people are automatically going to be more attracted to these insane ideologies.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And they're also more likely to be dissatisfied with their mental health as well. So this is their own self-report on their own mental well-being. And liberal women, again, leading the pack with dissatisfaction by a reasonable amount. Liberal men also beating everyone there. It's also worth noting as well, conservative women tend to do pretty well there, more so than everyone else. So that's interesting, isn't it? Because, of course, the sort of common wisdom is that women tend to suffer more with mental health issues than men do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's clearly not necessarily true, depending on what you believe.
Yeah, and it does, again, bring up the order, chicken or the egg, is that are they in crazier to begin with, and that's what draws them towards these politics, or does the politics drive them to be unhappy?
Mm-hmm.
And well, I don't know which one's accurate, maybe a bit of both.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that your personality is dictated, your personality is dictated by your genes to a certain extent, a reasonable extent, actually, and your personality dictates your politics to a large extent. So it seems to be that there's this thread going through things here whereby the certain neuroses may well be, you know, genetically inherited. So here's another one. They're just generally less happy with life. This is completely satisfied with your life by sex and ideology. This was 2022 poll of American families done by the UK government for some reason. I don't know why our tax money is finding this out, but it's useful at least. And yes, it's almost like 2-1, certainly for liberal women compared to conservative women, they're much happier. And there's got to be something to it, right? Either the conservatives are lying about their own happiness, you know, sort of faking it until they make it, or maybe there actually is a trend. And I think that
possible, but it would be odd for it to be that consistent.
Yes.
So potentially, but unlikely.
I do agree with that. I think that most of the time when people are talking about this sort of thing, they tend to be quite honest, mm-hmm. because depressed people tend to be relatively happy when filling out these surveys, mm-hmm. from my sort of knowledge of the research, in reporting how they actually feel. It's sort of almost a form of catharsis is the way they perceive the filling out the forms. So it makes sense.
And the individuation effects, which is being anonymous, people will tell you pretty much anything. As long as you tell them that they're anonymous, they'll say, sure, and open up about some really heavy stuff in surveys.
it's strange how people really police themselves with social repercussions, isn't it? So on to things to do with personality. And this was just asking in a survey a bunch of left-wing authoritarians, I presume. And I'm just going to read the part from the results here. It says, the results of multiple regression analysis showed that a strong ideological view, according to which a violent revolution against existing social structures is legitimate, for example, anti-hierarchical aggression, was associated with antagonistic narcissism, demonstrated in the first study, and psychopathy in the second study. However, neither dispositional altruism nor social justice commitment was related to left-wing anti-hierarchical aggression. So basically, narcissism and psychopathy dictate how much you want to be a left-wing revolutionary, more than their actual care for other people or their commitment to so-called social justice, which is quite a condemnation. So their purported reason for doing it isn't even as strong as their own self-interest, clearly.
Yeah, it's actually interesting that I'm glad to see that there's a new study with left-wing authoritarianism. If you don't know, this instrument's very new.
Mm-hmm.
It's for years, goes back to Altmaier, like in the 60s, and that developing the right-wing authoritarianism instrument. Mm-hmm. And that's been used for forever. It used to be called...
We've covered this before.
It used to be called the F scale, standing for fascism scale.
That was the Frankfurt School that developed California in the 50s,
Yes, which it came from the Frankfurt School, and then Altmaier rejigged it into being the right-wing authoritarianism instrument, which they use all the time. And it wasn't until about 3 years ago that they even developed this left-wing authoritarianism instrument, because the social scientists for decades, kept repeating, there is no such thing as left-wing authoritarianism, so let's not bother to develop an instrument to measure it.
Joseph Stalin, right-winger.
The funny thing is, if you look at the studies that were done on the authoritarian personality studies, now I've read a text that goes over a lot of the studies that the Frankfurt School, I think it was mainly Adorno, included in the authoritarian personality. And the guy I read goes through a lot of the responses and finds that what they were doing was they were getting these people to answer questions about their personal lives and their relationships to their own parents, how they felt about their parents, how they felt about themselves. And basically, the more stable and normal you seemed, they would label these people as being repressed and subject to authoritarianism. And the more unstable people were, the more dissatisfied they were in life, the more they had familial issues with their parents, or maybe they just had absentee parents in the first place, they would label these people as having some form of unrestrained liberty that was good for them. So I kind of characterize it like this, if you're going to go with the whole authoritarian scale, if you want to go left and right. So right-wing authoritarianism is you as the individual want to learn piano.
Me?
So the right-wing authoritarian... Piano, well, imagine for a moment there. Open up your imagination. So the right-wing authoritarianism say, okay, I'll let you play piano, but I'll hold you to strict rules and make sure that you apply yourself to your fullest so that you can learn to play piano. Left-wing authoritarianism is you go, Dad, I want to play guitar. And he goes, no, you're playing piano and every wrong note that you get, I'm going to break your finger. I think that's a good way of characterizing it.
Yeah.
You wouldn't be able to play piano for particularly long after that, would you?
Well, no, but that's the counterproductiveness of communism, isn't it? Really, we're going to build a worker society where if the workers don't do what we want, we'll send them to the gulags. Hmm.
So this next study is one of my favourites, and I've mentioned it quite a lot over the years. And this is signalling virtuous victimhood as indicators of dark triad personality. So they were looking at consequences and predictors of emitting the signal of victimhood and virtue signaling. Of course, virtue signaling is like saying, oh, I'm, you know, I can't get a job because I'm black in America and things like that. That's, you know, I've done nothing
it's
wrong.
It's not my criminal record, I swear.
The fact I was stealing his phone in the job interview, you know, it had nothing to do with it. So there's a series of six studies which they went through and sort of tested their conclusions of each study. And I really like studies like this.
This is huge. And they're really creative studies too. So if you do have time to read through it and care about stuff like this, this is a really fascinating piece. I covered it extensively on a video I did about virtuous victimhood about a year ago. So yeah.
I absolutely love this one. So do humor me for going over it. But So it basically operates under the theory that modern victim signaling is about non-reciprocal resource extraction from institutions or individuals more resource rich than themselves. And I believe that this is the animating principle that governs a lot of politics more generally. I believe that particularly elites, as well as lots of other people as well, engage in politics to extract resources from other people as a strategy of acquiring resources themselves. Mm-hmm. I think that a very large amount of politics basically comes down to this fundamental truth that politics is resource extraction. I know this makes me sound sort of autistically libertarian, and I will talk about taxation eventually, but it basically amounts to material things like money, jobs, and access to education, as well as symbolic things such as respect, tolerance, and compassion. These are all words as well that have been co-opted by the left. Almost saying them makes my skin crawl these days. But basically, they showed that individuals with dark triad traits more frequently signaled their virtuous victimhood in the Western world. And that the dark triad, if you're not familiar, is narcissism, Machiavellianism, and psychopathy. And these are characterized by narcissism, grandiosity, pride, egoism, lack of empathy. Machiavellianism, which is doing Machiavelli dirty, really, but still. Is manipulation and exploitation of others, an absence of morality, unemotional callousness, and a higher level of self-interest. And psychopathy, I think everyone knows. But yes, it's just being selfish, impulsive, and being remorseless and brutal. And It will say, some people will repeatedly emit this signal in an opportunistic manner to initiate non-reciprocal resource transfer. It says, our first three studies demonstrated how a perceived victim signal can lead others to transfer resources to a victim, but that the motivation to do so is amplified when the victim signal is paired with a virtue signal. And those with the dark triad trait signal more often. And in this third study of theirs, of the six, they showed that these virtuous victim signalers were more willing to purchase counterfeit products and judge counterfeiters as less immoral compared to less frequent signalers. And that was a pattern which was also observed when using participants' dark triad scores instead of how much they signaled, just in case that signaling score wasn't as good, a sort of proxy for that metric. And also, they were also more likely to lie and cheat and steal. Mm-hmm. For extra monetary rewards in a coin flip game.
Yep.
So yes, these virtuous victims are not so virtuous after all. And also communal narcissism was a significant predictor of the frequency of it. And that's basically narcissism, but for a sort of identified group.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be a sort of a collectivist impulse, which is right. Interesting.
And another thing too about the narcissism in general is that there are two types of narcissism. I think in this one they did collapse it to just a generalized narcissism instrument, mm-hmm. but there is grandiose narcissism and vulnerable narcissism. And in some of the research that I've looked at, it seems, because when you hear the word narcissism, you think usually someone who is ostentatious, outgoing, very full of themselves, that's grandiose narcissism. But vulnerable narcissism is oftentimes people have very low self-esteem, or they get depressed and they want other people to, or they act depressed because they want people to give them attention. Grandiose narcissists already like themselves, so they provide their own attention. Then the vulnerable narcissist doesn't get attention or doesn't get what they want. They become very upset. And I think that, and from the research I've seen, the left tends to have a real big problem with vulnerable narcissism, not with grandiose narcissism. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you think of Andrew Tate, there's a narcissist, but that's that vulnerable narcissism, the mm-hmm. I need attention, I need people to care for me. That's vulnerable narcissism.
That would explain the prevalence of the cry bully
yes,
archetype
exactly.
on the left.
Yep.
Yes. So what they basically conclude is that a lot of the people that are emitting these signals are sort of aware of what they're doing as well, which mm-hmm. is interesting. And it sort of makes it all the more insidious. If it were sort of unconscious and they weren't really aware that they were doing it in this way, it would make it at least a little bit more excusable, perhaps. But
sort of. The part of this study, because I had this up here too, I don't remember from which one of the experiments and it was, is that they were more prone towards fantasy thinking mm-hmm. and towards exaggeration of what had happened in the past. So I think it's more that they gaslight themselves into thinking things are different from how they actually are because they invent fantasies and exaggerate until they believe their own lies. I mean, at least that's from some of the research in this set.
I can certainly see that happening mm-hmm. because
oh yeah,
a lot of the time when you argue with left wings, which I've unfortunately done a fair amount of, they straw man you constantly and you'd be like, hang on, this is what I believe, at least argue against that. And then they'll take the most uncharitable interpretation. It's like, well, you're not interfacing with mm-hmm. reality anymore, are you?
Because that's what they heard. Mm-hmm. They engaged in fantasy thinking and exaggeration and just heard whatever they mm-hmm. wanted you to, what they wanted to hear. So,
whereas when I approach arguing with someone, I try and look at, particularly when it's written, the words they've said and argue the point rather than the idea or putting like an idea in their mind or saying, oh, you really mean this.
Yeah, but then you can't engage in solipsism. So
yeah,
that's
well,
no fun.
It's not as fun. And here's one that you actually drew my attention to.
Oh, yeah.
And this one was kind of a bit harrowing as well. It's titled, where is it? It's got a different title there.
There's two from
there's
this.
There's two titles.
Oh, but no, there's two from this research cohort that I talked about that are they're published in the same year.
Mm-hmm. But this one is titled, Each is to Count for One and One for More Than One. Which is a very confusing title, actually. Predictors of Support for Economic Redistribution, which is a very bland title for a very interesting study. And I wanted to draw attention to this table here, because these are predictors of support for coercive redistribution. And so coercive redistribution is taking people's resources via the state, one would presume, but not mm-hmm. necessarily, and then redistributing them among probably like-minded individuals. And the effect size here is the most interesting thing to me because the ones that are actually significant here, malicious envy, self-interest, to a certain extent, communal fairness, although it doesn't, it has the lowest effect size, and instrumental harm. Obviously, malicious envy, we kind of know what that is. They're envious of people with more resources than them. Self-interest, again, is pretty self-evident. The communal fairness, again, you can say, well, there is some sort of, they perceive it via the nexus of this fairness imbalance, even though there may be perfectly legitimate reasons why someone has more resources than them. And the instrumental harm was the interesting one, because it's kind of a nebulous term, but what it actually means is it gives a moral agent permission to instrumentally use and severely harm or even kill innocent people to promote the greater good, which is, you know, very hot fuzz of them. And that's the concerning one. Yeah. And that one's the second most significant effect size of them all.
So to clarify, that's people who essentially already want to hurt other people and are simply looking for a virtuous excuse to do so?
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, and the coercive redistribution is, it was up to it, including killing or torturing or seriously harming other people to redistribute. Mm-hmm. In this, I mean, that in every experiment, because there were a couple of them, this one too, if I remember correctly, but this one I haven't read as recently. And I think the thing with fairness too is that it's the way that the instrument is loaded, it probably is perceived fairness of wanting to be seen as fair. So you would answer questions on that questionnaire being like, yes, I'm a very fair person because that's the one of the two morals that really matters to leftists. So it makes total sense to me as to why fairness is significant, as well as, yeah, if you don't do what I want, I'm going to torture you. Like, it actually does align with their psychological profile.
And of course, we've seen this manifest. I think that the Soviet Union was a legitimate manifestation of left-wing ideology. I know there are some people that argue about that, but it's nonsense. Of course it was. You don't get collective farms unless you believe in collectivism, do you? And we saw torture and murder on a mass scale in the name of fairness.
Really inventive and horrible, harrowing ways of torturing people as well. If you only read the first few chapters of the Gulag Archipelago.
That's one of the only books in my life I couldn't actually finish.
Well, yeah.
Because it was so harrowing.
Solzhenitsyn just discussing the really mundane ways that you could torture somebody into granting a confession. Just sitting someone in a chair that's a little bit too high for your feet to be able to touch the floor, so your feet go numb, and having them sat there for hours and hours and hours on end without being allowed to get up or sleep.
The one that got to me was making a really old man stand in a corner for 3 days straight, and as soon as he sort of fell over or sat down, they would shoot him. It's just pure evil. There's no reason, ideological or otherwise, to do that to another human being. But I suppose that's why I'm not a leftist. But on the topic of leftist ideology, one of them is the LGBT movement, and certainly the ideological component of it anyway. And of course, this is skyrocketing at the minute because, of course, it's not biological. It's a sort of social contagion more than anything. And yes, nearly 4 in 10 young liberal women identify as LGBT. And I find this interesting because there has been research into sort of personality of people like this. And I like this one just because of the title, mainly. The dark side of the rainbow. Homosexuals and bisexuals have higher dark triad traits than heterosexuals. And it reads that bisexuals and homosexuals were more Machiavellian than heterosexuals, and bisexuals were more psychopathic and narcissistic than heterosexuals. The only significant finding in within-sex comparisons showed that self-identified bisexual women score higher on all dark triad traits than heterosexual women, which is interesting, isn't it?
Well, is not part of that likely because of the identification part, because it's in vogue to do so. Mm-hmm. So in particular, it makes sense then why, and I find a lot of women identify as bisexual because it's non-committal. So you get to be in the LGBT umbrella, but you don't have to actually do anything. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing as being, in that sense, as being, what do they call it? A non-binary, where you can just keep go about doing everything you were doing before, but now they have to call you by Zimzer or something.
Yeah, it's more of an ideological and social status signifier than an actual lifestyle that these people are adhering to.
One could say a virtue signal.
Yeah. Yep.
And hence the dark triad relationship there then.
Yeah, and I think that they're obviously people who probably are there for genuine reasons.
Sure.
I'm not necessarily dismissing that. I don't think that, you know, all homosexuals are psychopaths, for example. So if you're watching Hope Not Hate, please, I do want a bank account.
But if you feel like maliciously editing and clipping this, then, you know,
yeah, go right ahead. Can't really stop you. And just to add fuel to the fire, I wanted to end on something that is a little bit controversial, although it's not framed like this. This is on nature.com, so, you know, the premier journal in science. And I'm going to read a little bit about this. So it's facial recognition technology that can detect facial facial orientation, political orientation from just regular pictures of people. And it looked at over 1 million individuals, and it correctly guessed the political orientation in 72% of cases, whether they were liberal or conservative. And obviously the by chance one is 50%, and the human accuracy is 55%. So this is absolutely massive. Even when you give someone a personality questionnaire, you can only guess their political orientation 66% of the time. So the fact that technology can do this is interesting for multiple reasons. One is the sort of Skynet one, where I am absolutely terrified that the state is going to use CCTV to track people of my political persuasion to do us in. And the second thing is that this is kind of a vindication of physiognomy, isn't it? That you can kind of tell what someone's politics are just by looking at them. And it's not exactly politically correct, even amongst, you know, some on the purported right to say these sorts of things. But I think that if genetics determine personality, which determines politics, then genetics also determine what you look like in a far more direct way. Because your physical appearance is affected by genes, which also affect personality, they're not necessarily independent of one another, that there is overlap there. It's not necessarily 100%, but there's a significant degree of overlap. That's why when you domesticate animals, their physical appearance changes, even though you're only selecting for tameness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. There have been a couple of studies that have to do with the facial structure and political beliefs. So this wouldn't just come out of anywhere. But it's interesting now that the AI is so accurate at it. And that is the terrifying part, is that, oh yeah, I could see some governments loving to use this to track people just based on, yeah.
You've got a dissident face.
You've got a dissident face.
Yeah. I believe the facial recognition technology is something that's either already been implemented in Scotland or is being implemented up there and is beginning to be implemented here as well. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there is some worrying implications. But on the actual science of the matter, I find it absurd that anybody would even deny that the human brain, which is a pattern recognition machine, developed over hundreds of thousands, if not longer, years, wouldn't be able to recognize particular patterns about how people look and how people who look in a particular way behave. And there's a reason there's a Baz meme about British people. And Bazes are known to behave in a particular way. And if you meet a Baz in public, yeah, he's probably going to act like you would expect the Baz to behave.
Well, there's also a certain thing that the behavior dictates the appearance, in that the doughy face comes from years of sinking lager, which I respect, by the way. That's not
and
slight.
And darts as well, of course.
He's got the perfectly weighted arms with this great big counterweight hanging off.
Have you seen that
throw,
where darts players lose weight and stop being good at the game all of a sudden? And they put the weight back on and they're back to top form.
I like a sport where the unhealthier you are, the better you get. There needs to be something for people like me.
Maybe it is something to do with the balance of having a big wobbly belly. Yeah.
It keeps you grounded. It's like a counterweight, isn't it? But my point being in all of this, that there are lots of things that you wouldn't necessarily intuitively discovered looking at politics and sort of even trying to be quite analytical about it from research like this. And I think it's actually very valuable. And I imagine that you feel much the same.
Oh, yeah. I mean, academia is completely captured, obviously. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean that sometimes interesting information doesn't still get through it. The people who are totally ideologically driven, they are going to do their best to try and suppress information like this. But it does happen because most scholars are not complete lunatics and just want to study their one weird thing that they're interested in. When talking back a little bit about the gender issues and with women having more what was it? Oh, more likely to be bisexual. There was that rapid onset gender dysphoria study from 2012 that has been more or less completely retracted. And the reason why was because they asked parents to say, hello, my child in the last 6 months has suddenly started identifying as transgender. And in that study, it was two to three to one, females identifying as males rather than the vice versa. And what they found was if one of these girls in high school had one friend who came out as trans, all of them did. And that study was more or less, the problem was because they asked the parents to identify it, they didn't ask the students to identify themselves. So the study was thrown out as bad methods. But I still think that there's value in that study. The left was unhappy with it. And all of a sudden, they are not the party of the science. They're not the group of science when they doesn't align with their pet beliefs. However, most people just don't pay attention to this stuff. So, you know, sneaks by.
I mean, I was a great big nerd and did a master's in research methodology. So I love going through this sort of thing.
Oh, yeah.
My bread and butter.
Yep, me too.
Sorry, I've insulted you by association there.
Oh, no.
Absolute nerds. And I mean that with all due respect.
Whoa. If I wasn't a nerd, I wouldn't be here.
Neither would I, to be honest.
Same.
Well, that's a weird way to end the segment, but there we go. The left are weird, and that's why. Anyway, on to
everybody
your
type
stuff.
N in the comments, and that's for nerd.
Yep.
Nerd, everybody. The N for nerd.
What have you done?
All right, Anakin. What have I done? Okay.
As long as they're not killing you. Oh, that's the left.
Yeah.
They're castrating the younglings.
It's all right. We're between segments. We can say this now.
Yeah. Now we're on. I'll let you two finish your drinks.
Very courteous of you.
Is that a Chris Williamson Newtonic sports drink that you have there?
Wow, it is.
To be fair, actually, I ran out of coffee ages ago. Let's see what this tastes like. And yes, Chris, if you like this clip, if it actually is really nice, and I say so, you can use this for your
advertising. He's not paying us any money.
He's not. He's what? What, John? The laptop's blocking it. Ha ha. Here is
Chris Williamson. I hope you like us. We're not
Newtonic,
doing this for any reason.
Newtonic productivity drink with an eyeball on it. Very 1984 Big Brother. This is Chris's eyeball. He's watching all the time.
You've closed your laptop. That's where you're meant to read your notes, isn't it?
I don't need notes.
Oh, good.
I'm guided by the power of Anglo-autism. Right, let's see what this is like.
Mostly the latter, I think. That's a big slurp. Poor listeners.
That's actually
I'm sorry.
Nice. That's actually... Thank you, Chris. This is a good drink.
Oh, horrible.
Come on, it's not that bad. Stop being such a girl's blouse about it, Josh.
I don't like slurping.
You know, stop being such a big girl's blouse. Plouse. Blouse, you fanny.
A great big plow.
Yeah, stop being...
Go back to the fields, Josh.
Yep.
I've been playing a lot of Manalords, all right, to be fair. So.
All right. Okay. Back to the serious subjects of our podcast, because we're a very serious podcast that's taken very seriously across the entire news media world. We'll talk about the ultimate edition, the next evolution, as you put it, of white flight. That evil thing where white people say, actually, I don't want to live in a crime-ridden hellhole. Terrible, terrible, I know. But before I get into that, I'd like to announce to everybody on YouTube that we are currently looking for people with skills in videography, audio, and editing who are available to work in the London or Swindon area. If you're interested in full job specifications for our new career opportunity as production manager, you can find that at lotuseaters.com/careers or lotuseaters.com/career-production-manager. And it's all on there. And you can send us in a job application if you are interested. Thank you very much. Let's get on with this. So we know that there's a paradox. Everything is paradoxical these days. Everything is completely upside down. The left have gone loony, as always. Somebody's lost their marbles, and I'm sure that it's not me. As we know that there are always contradicting ideas that we have to hold in our heads at all times, in all places. But it all centers around one unifying theory, that being I hate whitey. This is the unifying ideology of our days. And we know this because you see these two contradicting ideas held at the same time, which is gentrification is bad, white flight is bad. And both are signifiers of some kind of anti-black or anti-POC racism. And to get an example of this, I just found this study that was done by Zawadi Rux Ahidiana called Theorizing Gentrification as a Process of Racial Capitalism. Now, this I say study, this is an essay where it basically just says, if white people move into a low-class ethnic neighborhood and make it nicer, this is racism. This is racism and it's capitalism. We know that capitalism is evil in the first place. And at the same time, you have to hold that idea in your head while you also have to hold this idea that white flight is bad as well. So white people move in, bad. White people move out, also bad.
I love the argument implicit in the gentrification argument because it's basically like wherever white people go, they make things nicer.
Oh, they bring civilization. It's terrible.
It is amusing. It's like wherever the beaver goes, he has to build a dam. Wherever the white man goes, he has to build a functioning society. This is the implicit, what's implicit in these, of course. So, this is actually quite an interesting article, even though the title is saying white flight might still enforce segregation. Now, this is from 2021, and they point out here, this is a part of the APA, white Americans perceived a threat to their culture and way of life when presented with information about changing demographics in hypothetical white majority neighborhoods and schools, compared with when no demographic change was projected. Now, that seems to me to be an obvious result from that question, because yes, if all of a sudden people with a foreign culture, different ways of life move in, obviously you're going to have more of a threat to the culture and way of life in that local area than if nobody was moving in at all. And that's not even necessarily something that you can divide along racial lines, that you have to at least. You can also say, well, literally anybody moving in and out of a place will change to a certain extent the character, if only in minute or larger ways, depending on how different these people are. And they pointed out here, even, and this is quite interesting and ties into something that we were speaking last time about how the left tends to speak out of both sides of its mouth at the same time and be duplicitous and dishonest in how they communicate. Even liberal white parents have resisted sending their children to integrated schools in New York City and other areas. Because, of course, it's but basically the left operates in a segregation for me, integration for the mindset. This is why you end up with parts of, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but as far as I'm aware, the demographics of parts of America, like the New England in the Northeast, mm-hmm. is still very majority white.
Yeah.
And that's where people tend to be most liberal outside of the coastal parts of the West Coast.
Yeah. And you'll find that the segregation is astonishing in some left-leaning cities, where they're all left-leaning. Mm. But I grew up in Baltimore, and a friend of mine, very wealthy family. They live in essentially a gated community that is right in the center of Baltimore, but it's all pretty much white people. These are multi-million dollar houses. Three blocks away, there's shootings every day, and it's a complete, but there is no connection between those two people. Yeah, they live next to each other, but they are completely segregated.
Yeah, it's interesting that these things tend to operate as a form of luxury beliefs. Right. The ultra-left-wing liberal ideas operate as a way that you can signal your own virtuous mm-hmm. nature. You can have a function of social signaling. And also, again, to tie into the previous segment, if you're really left-wing, it's a way of harming other people as well. If you know that integration in particular communities, integration of particular communities will end up in one way or another harming people that you don't like, then you're going to encourage that as long as the second order effects don't end up at your doorstep. So that's what we find in things like this. And I'll carry on here saying that since 2000, the population growth of, because this is all about the demographic change of America, population of growth of Latino Americans has accounted for more than half of the population growth in the United States. According to the U.S. Census projections, the United States will be majority-minority nation by 2044, when non-Hispanic whites will make up just under 50% of the population, compared with approximately 25% for Hispanics, 13% for blacks. I find it amazing that the percentage of blacks seems to just be constant in America.
Could have something to do with abortion, I don't know.
That's possibly something to do with it. 8% for Asians and 4% for multiracial people. Non-Hispanic whites currently make up approximately 58% of the U.S. population. Again, this is APA. Just saying it out loud. Yeah, demographic change is happening. White replacement is happening. We're bringing in all of the Mexicans. And yes, if you live below the southern border of America, it doesn't matter which country you're from, you're Mexican. Sorry to break it to you all there. But remember, it's just a conspiracy theory.
Right, right. Until it's not, until then it's a good thing. It's, yeah. What's the old phrase? It's not happening unless we want it to happen, and then it is happening and it's good. So,
yes, and of course, changing demographics will bring changing cultures, changing way of lives. And with this, I'd like to bring us all to a nice city profile that I have prepared of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, the capital city of the U.S. state of Louisiana, which is located on the eastern bank of the Mississippi River and had a population of 227,470 as of 2020.
So you were in my contemplations understanding America, weren't you? Mm. And the state of Louisiana won out on some rather embarrassing titles.
Unflattering, yes. Mm-hmm. The people were too law-abiding, far too healthy. Not a bit of obesity there at all. No, it was the very, very unflattering metrics that it won out on, sadly. And I'll go through a little bit of information. So it's got a strong economy. It's helped the city to be ranked as one of the top 10 places for young adults in 2010 by Portfolio.com, and one of the top 20 cities in North America for economic strength by the Brookings Institution in 2009. It was ranked by CNN as the ninth best place in the country to start a new business. Now, I noticed that these, about 15 years ago, these metrics that we're reading from here, so I don't know if it's still the same. So they have Amazon in 2021. The distribution center, Chicago Bridge and Iron Company had an office in Baton Rouge, but it was sold in 2017, so not anymore. Oh, exciting news though! In 2023, they got an Aldi.
Wow,
moving up.
highest of high culture.
They're moving to America now. They're taking over the world. Have you noticed actually? If you scroll back up again,
oh yes,
their state capitol building is an actual castle. I'm sorry. Credit where credit's due.
Yeah, no, that is a good absolutely. The thing is with these old cities in America that have been there for years, a lot of the older architecture is still quite nice because it was when the people who moved there were either trying to emulate the countries that they were from or just emulate styles that they really appreciated, in the same way that the founding fathers appreciated the old Roman Republic style, which is why you get all the lovely old column buildings in Washington.
Yeah, classical stuff, yeah.
Yeah, I really like some of the architecture in parts of America. But if we go down to a very important bit here, we can see again the demographic change that has been happening in Baton Rouge. So from 2000 to 2020, the white population went from 44 to 34%, and the black population went from 49 to 53%, and Mexicans, are the ones who are growing the most. They went from 1.72% to almost 6%. In those 20 years, because obviously it's all coming up through the southern border, so they're spreading out across the southern states first. And you can see here that they have this handy map, which shows, again, as we were talking about, there is pretty much segregation in the city. So the green spots of this map here, if I click on it, here we go, are the black populations, and the blue spots are the white population. So you can see there's just a definitive cutoff line right in the center here.
That's all well and good, but now let's see a crime map.
Well, actually, just give me a moment. First of all, you're kind of jumping ahead here.
Sorry,
a bit, Josh.
Harry.
No, I appreciate it. What it means is that you can predict things using pattern recognition. But I will read out some of the crime bits that they have on the Wikipedia page here if I scroll down a bit. So, since the 21st century, Baton Rouge has had one of the worst crime rates in the nation. Baton Rouge is approximately 54 crimes per 1,000 residents, which is higher than the national average of 23. I mean, that's almost that's over double, and the Louisiana average of 34. In 2021, Baton Rouge set a homicide record.
Congratulations.
Whoa, break out the party poppers, boys. Get me a 40 ounce from the shit store. We partying hard tonight with 149 homicides. In 2022, Forbes ranked it the eighth most dangerous city in the U.S. For the first time in Baton Rouge's history, the homicide count has reached at least 100 for four consecutive years, 2020 to 2023. Historically, it's not known for much gang activity, but since the 2020s, it has been growing and becoming a major concern. Mm. And it leads to websites like this, Deep Sentinel, asking, is it safe? And this is for anybody who's going to be moving there, if you're thinking of maybe starting a business on the basis of a CNN article from 15 years ago. And they talk about this, they give the same figures in here, but as part of this, they also break down the types of crime. And you can see most of it is property crime. So you're very likely to be broken into. And they give this little map here of the safest neighborhoods of Baton Rouge.
Hang on, they're all very southerly. And if
hang on a
rightly,
moment.
I don't recognize any pattern here. There's no correlation.
This is all coincidental.
It is, yeah.
It's all coincidental. All cultural factors. And they also list a few of the most diverse neighborhoods. Mm. Now, if I go up here, back to the safest ones, there is no overlap. Mm. There is no overlap whatsoever. But what they also point out here is that they've taken polls of people who live there, how safe that they feel. And it just says, Baton Rouge residents don't necessarily feel safe. More than 80% of poll respondents on Area Vibes rated crime in the city as awful or poor, and a full 60% of respondents said they never walk alone at night. As is often the case, the safer neighborhoods tend to be further from Baton Rouge's downtown area, as you can see from that little map. It's also been the site of a lot of trouble over the years since the Black Lives Matter protests started to go on. So in 2016... they had a lot of these protests going on that captured this legendary photo. And you can tell that it's legendary, lived on, iconic, Slay Queen, because nobody past the week this photo was taken can remember this photo.
I've never seen it before.
No, nor have I.
Well, everybody wants to be the Rosa Parks photo.
Right, yes.
Everybody wants to recreate their 1960s civil rights fantasy.
They want to be putting flowers
in the flower and the gun, yeah.
Yeah, they want to be doing that, which were all staged photo shoots anyway. But they don't, because the news cycle doesn't care about you. I mean, look at some of this. Look at her posture. She's balanced, powerful, upright, well grounded, with both feet firmly planted. Yeah, she's standing up straight.
It's nice that our state media is using Facebook post sources as well.
Facebook comments underneath a Sean King post.
Excellent.
Credible source if ever I've seen one. But I'll read some of what happened back in 2016. So there was a demonstration organized by Black Lives Matter. It took place days after the police killed Alton Sterling in Baton Rouge. I looked into the case. It was a black man who was trying to sell CDs out of a shop, waved a gun around at some guy, got the police called on him. Then when the police arrived, they tried to restrain him. And while he was on the ground, he tried to reach for a loaded 38 caliber in his pocket. So they shot him before they could get shot themselves. And of course, Black Lives Matter decided this was a travesty. He didn't do nothing. He was a good boy. He was turning his life around, et cetera, ignore that he'd already been to prison on violent charges in the past. A video.
Many such cases.
How the BBC presents it is a video showed two white police officers holding him down and shooting him. No context. They just saw a black
just
man.
Just executed him.
They just held him down, said, you know what, boys? I feel like killing some tonight.
They also said this was MAGA country.
And of course.
They had a Trump flag behind. Maybe they had a Confederate flag as well. Somewhere.
Oh, for sure.
Probably. I think one of them was a direct descendant of Robert E. Lee, perhaps even. Police said they received a report an armed man was making threats. I love just how much context they always leave out of these things. Mm-hmm. In an atmosphere of heightened racial tension and amid growing debate over the seeming militarization of the American police, one photo stood out, and they go over this photo taken by Jonathan Backman. And he said, I feel it's representative of the peaceful demonstrations that have taken place here. People are very angry and have gone through a tremendous amount of pain, but they have not turned to violence, except even in the BBC, they kind of have to admit the protests weren't exactly peaceful. Louisiana's The Advocate newspaper said that 102 people were arrested with 8 guns seized. One police officer lost several teeth after being hit by a projectile. So peaceful, fiery, but mostly peaceful, and homicidal, but mostly peaceful as well, because this is something that I actually read about in Andy Ngo's book, and when he was talking about anti-fascism and Antifa, and this was a case that he highlighted in that. But I thought I'd go over it here because once again, this is in the immediate weeks following the Alton Sterling murders, and this happened in Baton Rouge. This is the Gavin Eugene Long shootings. Now, he didn't even live in Baton Rouge, but he traveled about 700 miles after the BLM protests so that he could go and commit these shootings. And it was on July 17th, 2016, he shot six police officers in Baton Rouge in an ambush attack in the wake of the shooting of Alton Sterling. Four died, including one who was critically wounded and died from complications in 2022. So this is all on your doorstep. You've got lots of property crimes going on. You've got record homicides in your city. You've got constant unrest and civil disorder going on. People are protesting. People are protesting the police. People are going out and murdering the police. You're not feeling all right to go out at night. You're not safe even in the daytime. What would you do in this bustling utopia?
There's one thing I can't say on the internet because it'll be there forever. But the other thing I might do is move.
Yep, leave.
Well, what if I told you you didn't actually have to move? You instead just declare the south side of the city a new city that has nothing to do with the northern side of the city.
They're going
to
build a wall and make the those people pay for it.
Well, I don't think they'll have much money to pay for it, but they are certainly going to declare themselves separate, and this will annoy people who think that peaceful, law-abiding, high-trust citizens should be forced to share public services and fund through their own taxes going towards affirmative action and benefits and such, the criminal activity of those of the underclasses. So what's happened here is they point out in this, they title it, "Wealthy white Louisiana residents win the right to form their own city and split from poorer black neighborhoods in landmark court ruling after a 10-year battle." Wealthy white Baton Rouge residents have won a decade-long court battle to split from poorer neighborhoods and form their own city with plans for better schools and less crime. Louisiana Supreme Court ruled on Friday that the new city of St. George, I like that name, could move forward with incorporation splitting from the rest of Baton Rouge. St. George will have 86,000 residents across a 60-square-mile area in the southeast of East Baton Rouge Parish and have its own mayor and city council.
Will its flag be white with a red cross in the middle?
Perhaps. We'll have to see, won't we?
It's going
to
be an English enclave.
Perhaps.
It's our patron saint. So,
supporters of the new city say that the existing city parish government is poorly run with high crime rates and bad schools. I see no inaccuracy there. Opponents say the move is racist and will create a white enclave as it separates a wealthy area of the city from the black majority city and school district. So, yeah, I mean, I'm sorry to say it in so bluntly. Yeah, that's basically the point. These are the people who are earning the wealth in the city. These are the people who are creating a more high trust, low crime rate society in the south side of the city. So if all of their taxes are going to fueling those people committing the crimes and fueling the public services, which are probably corrupt, poorly run, not functional, then yes, absolutely, I think they should have 100% of the right to say, we don't want to be part of this anymore. We want to separate ourselves and form an actually functioning city.
This is what happened in South Africa, isn't it?
Yep. Well, it's a town called Onania or something like that.
Urania, something like that. Well, where the Channel 4 sent a disabled black guy to come and go, why are you racist, though?
Right.
And complain on camera about how uncomfortable he felt there, while, you know, just a load of white South African families were having barbecues and picnics, not being worried about being murdered for their skin color. He was there going, oh, I just feel so uncomfortable here.
I saw an article recently about there was a transformer, obviously an electrical transformer, installed. I think it was in South Africa, and the colonized peoples of Africa decided to destroy it, disabling their electricity to use the liquid in it for cooking oil.
Excellent.
Yeah, this is what these South Africans have to live with.
Oh.
Listen, if you don't want every single country, every single city, every single town, every single neighborhood to turn into Johannesburg or Haiti, then you're a racist and you're evil.
Well, it's only a problem if it's white people doing it, right? That's the only time it's an issue. If any other group decides that, no, we want to have our enclave, we need our space, that's fine. But when white people do it, then it's racist.
Well, the UK government actually funded a black-only university. It was kind of forgotten, and I'm not sure whether it ran into any roadblocks. But I think we're supposedly completely fine with it, at least if I'm talking about the regime's perspective in sure. the West.
It's common in the United States. They have historically black colleges. I mean, they do accept white people, but for the most part, it's majority African-Americans who attend them.
The funny thing is, I mentioned Thomas Sowell earlier. He complains that it was the busing programs that emerged after Brown v. Board of Education that destroyed the quality of a lot of those historically black colleges. I think Dunbar School mm-hmm. is the example that he always goes back to, is it was producing the most black PhD graduates in the US. It was the place where lots of doctors and lawyers went to school. And then because of the busing programs and the forced integration after Brown, the school went to complete S mm-hmm. and doesn't function properly anymore. Now it's just another inner city ghetto school, which is tragic to hear. And I'll finish off with the bit that this article finishes off on. The tables that they looked at showed projected figures for St. George would create a town with an average income $30,000 higher than present-day Baton Rouge, while the unemployment rate would be halved. And according to the figures compiled by the Baton Rouge Area Chamber, the new town would have a majority white population, as opposed to Baton Rouge, which has a black majority, and the number of people receiving food stamps would also be more than halved.
That's quite the condemnation of Baton Rouge, isn't it?
Well, it's certainly a condemnation of one half of Baton Rouge, mm-hmm. sadly. But once again, if you want to have a functioning society, if you don't want to have to be holding like Atlas the entire world on your shoulders and just want to be able to live in a high trust society, and this is what they have to do for that, they absolutely should have the right. And I'm shocked but very pleased that the Louisiana Supreme Court permitted this. Not that I think that they should have to permit it, but I think it's quite remarkable that they have done so when they were obviously going to face a lot of accusations of racism. I don't know how politics, local politics works in Louisiana, but I know that this certainly wouldn't happen in very, very liberal states of America. So I think it's very impressive that this has happened in the first place. And I wish the residents of St. George best luck. And I hope that Baton Rouge can turn itself around. Because I poke fun and I'm very critical of the culture that develops in these majority black neighborhoods and populations, doesn't mean I don't think that there aren't good people living there who deserve a high quality of life themselves. Hopefully the rest of Baton Rouge can turn itself around, because at the end of the day, I wish nobody any ill will.
Hear, hear. I think, do we have video comments or is it written comments, John? Oh, here we are.
To all the young UK people looking to flee to my country of Australia, I thought I might give you some information about what you're in for. We're a land of contradictions that can both leftist and conservative at the same time. For instance, we have subscribed to the Western liberal consensus about importing foreign labour with a 30% foreign-born population, the highest in the Western world. However, we have so far avoided the worst of what London has experienced by being selective. Most of our foreign-born residents are from industrious nations, with England being the largest. A refugee intake, about 20,000, or 0.24%.
That's really interesting. You're getting lots of English refugees. I actually saw something recently that I think it was actually Callum Segment from yesterday that I watched last night, where he was talking about how lots of English people are now fleeing England because it's such a shithole, really. it's not going on YouTube anymore, so I can say it. Our country is terrible now, and we're all leaving to go elsewhere because there are actual opportunities. Like living and working in Britain, there's basically no point. I've given up most of my hope for a future, and that's not very encouraging for the audience, I know, but it's okay. There are greener pastures elsewhere. But it is kind of sad to see that, you know, I think, Harry, you must feel sort of similarly to me. I kind of want to go down with the ship, sort of like an old sea captain.
I think there's still hope in a lot of England. And I think that there are parts of England, mainly the more rural countryside, that still operates as England always has, where people can just live nice lives in little villages where they know everybody. It's a nice little community. I do think there are major hotspots where things are going downhill, and that's mainly in the cities. But also, as I've covered, and we might be doing a bigger project on soon, a lot of town centres across the country are going to complete shit. aren't functioning properly and are being left derelict and abandoned. And I think that's a problem, and I think it's a sign of very, very poor governance, which is really spreading like cancer across this country.
Well, to sort of counteract my depressing statement, if the Spanish can carry out a reconquista against the Islamic world, so can we. Which is probably not a particularly legal thing to say, but whatever. A legal reconquista.
A little Fed post here and there. Yeah, that's a little spice.
Uh-oh. Who's it gonna... Oh, it's me! Uh-oh. I look fat there. Oh, it's because I mentioned how I look with a mustache. Here we go. I can't pull off a mustache. I look like a sex offender. that was brilliant. Thank you for that.
Is that a Dragon Ball Z abridged joke there? The mustache thing?
I don't remember. I know I've heard that somewhere before.
Have you watched DBZ Abridged?
It's been a long time, but yeah.
Yeah, I think there's one where Vegeta grows a mustache and they have the little clip at the end in the post credits. Yeah. Sorry, that's some esoteric knowledge for everybody.
You know, every cloud has a silver lining. So when and if the economy collapses, at least all the migrants will go away because there won't be any more free stuff for them. I wonder if in about 50 years or so, folks are going to look at my mechs the same way Dan looks at the moon landings. Something else to look forward to, I suppose. That and Robo Waifu's goodbye message to Callum.
Yeah, Dan needs to see your mechs in person before he'll believe they exist. You may have lots of videos of you putting them together, manning them, knocking over things with inflatable swords, but until he's piloting it himself, it's all fake, man.
I think your next project needs to be, you need to build a rocket and send Dan personally to the moon.
Does Dan not believe that the moon's real?
I think he thinks it's a big ball of cheese in the sky. I think that's what he told me secretly.
Well, I mean, it is.
That is true, actually. Yeah. Have you not seen Wallace and Gromit?
I was about to say, yeah, that was a documentary, right?
It was, yeah.
Yeah, good.
This one's for Carl and Company. So what I'm showing here is fertility rates in the United States from 1800 to 2000. And as you can see, it's more or less linear downward. And the post-war boom is actually just a slight adjustment from the 1920s and 1940s where it dipped. What I'm saying right here is that there is no golden era where things have been good. Not in modernity, not in recent times. And it's not obvious to me that the way that you get fertility rates back up to where they used to be is going to be a clean and good solution. And we need visions of the future, not just pining for the past and tradition. We need to understand what's going on here, because this has been going on for over 200 years.
That's really good to point out, because I find the birth rate thing really quite annoying, because actually it's just if I've covered things like the mouse utopia before, and when there is enough of a replacement birth rate to fulfill society's needs. You know, human beings are conscious, we're aware of what's going on, but also there is a sort of unconscious element to it. But I think that population density and infant mortality are taken into account, and the fact that infant mortality has dropped along with the birth rates kind of makes sense. And I think that
it evens it out a little bit.
Yeah. And I think that as long as it's as cheap as humanly possible to raise a family, there's not really much cause to worry. And I think that what we should be worrying about is reducing the cost of having a traditional family rather than anything else. Mm. Like trying to force people to create kids, unless you're going to get, you know, trad calves bouncing on the bed to get people going. I don't know how it's going to happen.
Doing what to get people going? Jumping up and down on the bed going, procreate, procreate.
That's what, whenever I see like people on Twitter saying these sorts of things, that's what I imagine.
What you imagine?
Just like
Catholic,
them like hiding under the bed.
Well, like a Catholic patting the bed going, oh, you know, you want to. No, yeah, I think that it seems to me that birth rate seems to be correlated quite heavily with level of technological development and scarcity versus abundancy. If you have a society that's got a lot more abundance in it, then you don't have to have as many kids. And what that actually means is each of those children that you do have, say you've got 12 kids, it's really, really difficult to put a high level of one-on-one personal time with those kids. Whereas if you're in abundance and you don't have to worry that your kids are going to drop off like flies at the next disease outbreak, well, then you have a lot more time if you have fewer children to put personal one-on-one tutoring and emotional development and build that connection with them. Not saying that people in the past would have been any less close to their families, but that was one of the things with the development of the Western family structure, as far as I see it, is in comparison to other parts of the world, Northwest Europeans in particular, put a lot of a high investment in their children.
I think also because we do have so much abundance, as you brought up, it creates a perception, and particularly I think people in like my generation, Zoomers and millennials, I'm a millennial, but you know, that kind of age range, that you require so much more is actually required, is necessary to start a family than really is. Because it's the idea, particularly because the boomers had so much themselves, that I think a lot of younger people, millennials and zoomers, look at that and think, well, I don't have all the, I don't have a house because it's much more expensive than it was when the boomer generation was buying houses. I don't have, you know, all this free time to dedicate to raising children. Both parents are working, which wasn't usually the case, you know, with the boomer generation. And so even if they are able to have children, it seems like an insurmountable sort of task to even try and tackle.
No, that's very true. I think sometimes I catch myself thinking in those terms as well.
Hello, everyone. This video comment is for Josh. I recently watched your contemplations on veganism with David Rams, which I really liked. I was very interested to hear that you don't consume pork because of how intelligent pigs are, and I really appreciate you drawing attention to that. I also really appreciate you guys having on guests with different opinions on your show. Overall, I thought it was a really great discussion, so thanks a lot and take care.
I'm not particularly good at not consuming the pork. I had bacon this morning.
Oh no.
Harry,
bad timing.
Harry saw me do it.
I saw you do it. Josh and I had a very romantic breakfast together.
We did. Harry shared his hash browns with me, which I'm very grateful for. Thank you.
It's a sign of love and respect.
I also forgot my wallet and Harry paid for me as well. So, yes.
You're not giving me that fiver.
That's true, yeah. Shame me.
It's on camera now.
Shame me on the internet to repay Harry back. No, I'll do it after this.
Josh is just as much a swindler as he looks.
Yeah, I do have shady physiognomy, don't I? I can recognize it, don't worry.
No, you've got Britonic physiognomy.
Same thing.
Oh, okay.
So the comments, I can get back at you straight away. Harry's hepatitis riddled mug. Great to see him making another appearance.
Hey man, it's all for the immune system, right?
Catastrophic regression threshold says, well, this is a collaboration I never expected and I'm extremely pleased to see. Well, that's nice.
You'll be even more pleased to learn that Aiden's been on once before in that case. So you'll be able to find her on a previous episode of the podcast.
George Happ says, glad to have Aiden back. Her autistically researched videos are appreciated.
Well, I mean, look at that cover image you've got there.
And for What is Wrong with the Left, Annie Moss says, I really enjoyed Aiden Paladin. What a great guest. She had a lot of interesting things to say, and she was so polite too. Thank you for introducing me to her. I'll be looking into all her content now.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you.
Arizona Desert Rat says, Nerds of the World Unite.
Aiden, I still find it funny that my first introduction to your work was nothing to do with sociological studies. It was nothing even to do with politics. It was you falling asleep on EFAP.
Yeah, my ENAP, yes.
I don't understand how they can go for so long on those streams, man. Mahler must be made of caffeine.
Yeah, and I was in the US, but Mahler, you know, was over here, so it must have been like, well, I fell asleep fairly early. He must have been up all night. Yeah.
That man's brain must be bright green with all the monster he has to consume.
Maybe he's nocturnal.
Maybe. Mm. Still, 12 yeah. hours for a full stream.
I couldn't do that.
No, my throat would be sore.
I did like 7 or 8 hours and I was brain dead.
7 or 8 hours?
I recorded a lot here and then did a stream after.
Oh, all right, yeah.
Sophie Liv said, we need studies so we can reply when they say, where's your study, bro? Mm-hmm. Well, it's already going on, thankfully. I mean, I did studies. Lots of other people are doing studies. I hear lots about people in academia, in psychology in particular, carrying out, you know, work that is purportedly on our side. Mm-hmm. A lot of my lecturers I spoke to were pretty anti-woke, actually. They were just like, oh, it'll go away. You know, I study, you know, this niche part of cognitive psychology, they're not really going to come for me.
Yeah. Well, they just want to, again, they have their weird little niche nerdy interest that they're mm-hmm. hyper-focused on. Usually it tends to be how academics are. And they just want to be able to do their work. Most of them do. And not have this woke stuff come in and tell them they're not allowed to do it anymore because it doesn't meet some DEI criteria.
Yeah, and I do worry about the quality of research if they get more power, and it is affecting it to a certain extent, but there are lots of areas where mm-hmm. it's simply just not touched, which, unless you're looking for it, you wouldn't really know. Like, you had people back in, what, 2016, 2017, like Milo Yiannopoulos, who would just be like, all of psychology is basically rubbish. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's not true. But, you know, a lot of what he says is not true. Lars Petter Simonsen, I hope I pronounced your name right. Right-wing authoritarianism is overruling the individual on the basis of tradition. Left-wing authoritarianism is overruling the individual on the basis of contemporary power. Hmm. What do you reckon, Harry?
Based. well, the fact is contemporary power. I think that's kind of a vague statement, because contemporary power is going to be whatever is in power at the sure. time. So if you have right-wing authoritarianism, that means that right-wingers will be the head of an authoritarian state, which will make them the contemporary power. I think left-wing authoritarianism is overruling the individual on the basis of anti-traditional fantasy thinking mm-hmm. That attempts to transcend the human.
It's Hegelian.
Yeah, egalitarian as well, I think, is a good word to describe it.
Kevin Fox says, the facial recognition system had an advantage when it came to spotting lefties. The green eyebrows and blue hair are a dead giveaway. That's very true. Grant Gibson says, the funny thing about the virtuous victimhood one is that it came out of the most left-wing place in, I think that's meant to be Canada. I didn't actually look at the institution that it came from.
And I've read that. If it's the key one, I've read all of or a bunch of those, but sometimes again they're oblivious to it because mm-hmm. they don't understand, I think, how actually damning their own evidence is to leftist ideology or leftist culture, belief systems, whatever it is.
We can always rely on human stupidity to, you know, give us a peer behind the veil yeah. every now and then. And the final one from my section to give you some time is Mason Royce. If height is anything to go on, leftist reaction is the overwhelming need to reduce harm over anything else. And maternal instinct dialed up to 11. Don't like it, it's harmful, must eliminate. Yep. That's obviously true, yes, mm-hmm. absolutely.
That's certainly part of it. Mm-hmm. Sophie Liv, for mine, says, I feel like when you base your entire culture around doing the opposite of what made countries work because trying to copy it makes you a race traitor, there will be issues, I don't know. Yeah, again, I've been referring to him quite a bit, but he's always really good on the subject. But Thomas Sowell again, and quite a few other people, I forget what his name is now, he does a podcast with Glenn Lowry, or he's appeared on Glenn Lowry. John McWhorter has spoken quite a bit about the problem in majority black schools is that if you do get the one kid who is bright, he's driven, he wants to do something, he wants to study and achieve, he will get accused of acting white. So
yes.
there is a cultural reinforcement mechanism that exists within these schools that tells people that you're a race traitor if you're trying to achieve something, which is anti-civilizational behavior.
There is a way of combating this. You just make being academically successful a private thing. Like a lot of the time in my schooling, I didn't tell people that I was getting good grades. You just keep it to yourself. Keep it quiet so you're not accused of being a nerd.
In a school, people are going to find out.
You smart?
I think that's one of the reasons that people like Sol are very supportive of the...
charter schools?
The charter school initiatives, because there's a self-selection mechanism there that means that the kids who want to achieve will be able to achieve and be surrounded by kids who won't drag them down.
Yep. Dr. Roland G. Fryer, who's a professor of economics at Harvard, he's done actually work exactly on that, that acting white thing, because for years they've said that's not real. He got death threats for publishing that research. He's a black guy himself. Mm. And also, he also got death threats because he examined that blacks were not more likely to be killed by cops. They were more likely to be roughed up, but not killed by cops. And yeah, he had to have private security at Harvard.
Bloody hell.
Yeah. Well, that's the same university that hires Claudine Gay and maintains her on staff. Yeah.
Yeah. Lord Nerevar says, the Baton Rouge thing is frankly hilarious. The meltdown in response to it is even more so. That is, of course, until we start seeing fiery but mostly peaceful protests against it. But hey, that's what the Second Amendment is for. Yeah, I would say that St. George being so closely connected to, I mean, it was part of the same city, Baton Rouge, I know you said it as a meme, but I would suggest there to be some kind of essentially security force or perhaps wall built separating the two sections, because in all likelihood there will be organized leftist protests against it trying to burn parts of it down. We know that that's part of their game plan whenever they encounter anything like this, sadly, but that's the reality of living in the incredibly polarized world that we live in right now. And one last one, I'll say, Warlord Wutu Tai says, SCOTUS overruling Louisiana Supreme Court when? I don't think they would right now. I don't think they would, because even recently, wasn't it a 9-0 decision to strike down, what was it? Was it part of affirmative action, or was that...
Roe v. Wade one? You're thinking of overturning the decision in Colorado to strike Trump
right,
off the ballot.
Right, that was it, yeah.
Yeah, that was it. So it seems that the SCOTUS might be slanted more on the conservative side at the moment.
It is,
even,
yeah.
Well, it clearly it is. But I don't think the SCOTUS, even if it ended up being maybe a 5-4, would overrule this decision.
Well, it's not a federal matter,
no,
is it? It's a state matter. And
exactly.
So they would have no prerogative to be involved in that decision in the first place. It would be a massive infringement on state rights.
The Trump one suggests to me that I don't know, maybe the diversity hire has maybe been, I don't know.
It was so
more in
clear
line.
Cut that it's such a clear cut decision that the Constitution just explicitly states that it is the federal government that decides who's involved in federal elections, not the states. And it's just there in writing. So you can't really vote against that.
Some would have tried.
Yeah,
the Constitution has been overstepped by the Supreme Court before.
Mm-hmm. So I suppose we may as well end on pointing out that you have a Twitter account.
Yep.
Aiden Paladin, funnily enough. Mm-hmm. And of course, you have a YouTube account as well. There it is. I've seen quite a few of your videos.
Thanks.
I very much recommend them. And so, yeah, obviously check her out if you've enjoyed this. And thank you very much for watching, and goodbye.